All right. Thank you, everyone. Good afternoon. In this portion of the public hearing, the committee will hear from Department of Health and Community Services and Newfoundland Labrador Health Services. I would like to thank the witnesses for their appearance and welcome the following officials: Patrick Morrissey, Assistant Deputy Minister, Corporate Services; Dr. Pat Parfrey, Chief Executive Officer, Newfoundland Labrador Health Services; and Scott Bishop, Chief Financial Officer, Newfoundland Labrador Health Services. I will start with a few reminders for the witnesses and outline how this portion of the hearing will proceed before I call the clerk to swear in and affirm the witnesses. Witnesses, I am reminded that this is a public meeting and your testimony here today will be part of a public record. Witnesses appearing here before the Standing Committee of the House of Assembly are entitled to the same rights granted to members respecting parliamentary privileges. Witnesses may speak freely, and what you say in this parliamentary proceeding may not be used against you in civil proceedings. Live audio will be streamlined on the House of Assembly social media channels. An archived version will be available following the hearing. Answer will also be available once finalized. When called upon, please just activate your microphone. Identify yourself by saying your name first, and please remember to turn off your mic when you're finished speaking. First, I'll invite the Chief Executive Officer and Deputy Minister to make opening remarks. Then the committee members will pose questions in 10-minute periods. These rounds will continue until members have exhausted their questioning. I now ask the clerk to administer the oaths to the witnesses.
I, Patrick Morrissey, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I, Patrick Parfrey, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give in this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I, Scott Bishop, do solemnly and sincerely and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you. I now call upon the CEO of Newfoundland Labrador Health Services to bring opening remarks.
As you know, I'm only the CEO of Net Health Services since last Friday, but I have had discussions about the Auditor General's report with Karen Stone, who is the interim CEO, and with Scott Bishop, who will be our spokesperson in responding to the components of the Auditor General's report. I think that's probably enough for me at the moment.
Thank you. I now call upon the Deputy Minister of Health and Community Services to bring opening remarks.
So John McGraw sends his regrets, of course. So first of all, I just want to thank the chair and the committee for giving us the opportunity today to be here and answer any questions you have, and just thank you for all the valuable work that you do. And I also want to thank the Auditor General's Office, OCG, and staff at NHS in their efforts in completing this report. I also want to congratulate Dr. Pat Parfrey on his
commissariat
appointment for his new CEO. So I won't take up too much time. I just wanted to highlight a couple of the more significant things that are ongoing, I guess, that touch on some of the recommendations. So just a couple of things, including the fixed asset register that is known as an electronic funds transfer, are primarily due to the limitations of NLHS's existing finance and information system, Meditech. And, the department and NLHS are now working closely with the Office of Chief Information Officer and the Department of Finance on implementing a new enterprise resource planning system, which will effectively modernize finance, human resources, and procurement and supply chain technology. when it comes to the inventory, you know, we can get into more details, and Scott can for sure. But in the fall of 2024, a new warehouse management system was approved by government, which will modernize inventory control and take away that risk of or eliminate that risk of expiring wasted product. It was also noted in the report that there's a lack of an internal audit function, and you know, we're happy to say that since that time, the NLHS Board of Trustees, in partnership with HES, approved the establishment of an internal audit office within the health authority. That is ongoing, the recruitment efforts for that team. And then there are a few other recommendations, you know, some internal control issues that NLHS has addressed with compensating controls and other areas. And so I just wanted to highlight some of the major initiatives that are ongoing. So, we're happy to take your questions.
Okay, thank you. With that, we'll start questioning. And I now recognize the member for Mount Pearl North to proceed with questions.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for coming. I'm Lucy Stalls. I'm the MHA from Mount Pearl North. I'm assuming you know everybody at the table. Thank you for coming. Thank you to the other general for doing all the work that the her department and the department for doing all the work that they do for us and for the government. A couple of questions. The healthcare foundations, like the healthcare foundations, there's a bunch of them, the Janeway Foundation, the Blitz Center, the Trinity Conception Placentia Foundation, the Bureau, and the Grenfell Foundation. They're no longer, or the government don't have any control over getting financial statements and that from them. We're just wondering if your department is going to ensure that they do provide those accounts, or I know most of them are self-sufficient and everything, and you know, they raise funds, and most of the funds they raise, a lot of them are going back to the healthcare foundation and that to the government, you know, the hospitals and that. But we're just wondering, you know, what the protocol is, and if you're looking at putting any policies in place in that regard.
Scott Bishop speaking. Great question. I guess to settle the question that's been posed, Ms. Stoyles, I guess it comes down to an element of, as you mentioned, control. The current health authority and legacy health authorities does not actually affect the control of the foundations, although we partner with them for their fundraising efforts, and we certainly appreciate the major component of our work that they contribute to. But there isn't an element of control within the health authority, therefore they aren't consolidated to our financial statements as deemed appropriate by the Auditor General's Office. However, our current board bylaws, as passed by our current board of NLHS, does include an element whereby the foundations are required to provide our board with audited financial statements on an annual basis, and that's expected from all foundations. So that is an element of our board bylaws, in which the financial statements that are audited by their own auditors are presented to our board in completeness 9 months after its completion and audit for review by our board. We also have great partnerships with all our foundations in terms of our leadership in NLHS, but also our board itself and their involvement with our individual foundation board. So there's lots of partnership, synergies, and governance in terms of the relationship with the boards. But ultimately, it comes down to an element of control, in which NLHS does not control the boards, therefore they are not consolidated. But there is an element of our bylaws, our board bylaws, that require the foundations to present audited financial statements to our board on an annual basis.
And I just want to confirm that the chair of the board, of NLHS board, has created a subcommittee that includes all the CEOs of all the foundations, and they're about to meet.
Okay, so would the Auditor General be able to get a copy if the financial, because I don't think they were able to get a copy. That was my understanding anyway. I'm just wondering if it could be provided. Have you asked for it? And is the Auditor General's office entitled or able to get a copy of that? And if so, when can she get it? Or they get it?
As NLHS, we certainly have copies of those latest financial statements that are audited, and we can certainly work with the foundations to understand and the AG's office to understand what requirements might be there, but we can work through that and get back to the committee if that's the case. Yeah.
The other question, because we've been talking, of course, about in our committee meetings that about health and different aspects of the AG's report. And one of the questions I had, I don't know if it's actually related, is social workers. And I don't know if, and back, and this is what I'm told, and I deal with a lot of social workers, people calling looking for help in the district, not only my district. I say every MHA is doing what I'm doing if they get a call for seniors or you know, anybody looking for help and if they need a social worker and that. And what I've been told by a lot of people, especially the past 4 or 5 years, that social workers, I don't know if the job haven't changed, but now people don't have an individual social worker. Whoever is available when, if I need a social worker and I called the department, somebody would be assigned to me on that specific case. Everybody don't have. I understood back in the day that everybody had their own social worker. I'm just wondering if that has changed.
I'm not able to answer that question right now, but I can find an answer for it and get back to you about it.
Okay, because like I know it's very concerning to me, and I don't, you know, it's not really in the general's report, but I brought it up because it's been a concern to me as an MHA dealing with supervisors, and I know one, you know, elderly lady had 5 different, and people trying to get in nursing homes, they got 2 or 3 different social workers before they get in, and then children and that. So I'd just like to know if things have changed. That's it for me for questions right now.
Okay, thank you. The member for Placentia St. Mary's.
Good afternoon. I'm Sherry Gammon-Walsh, MHA for Placentia St. Mary's. So you kind of answered some of my questions in your introduction. Thank you very much for that. But that gave me more questions. So specifically around the Meditech system, you indicated that the fall 2024 new system was approved and we're about to implement new system for the 5 entities. So do you have any idea about the timeline for the implementation, where you are with that as it pertains to moving from Meditech separately to one as a whole?
So I just want to clarify. So the Meditech, there was nothing approved on that yet. We're working towards implementing a new system for Meditech. I think what I was referring to is the warehouse management system, which is the inventory system within NLHS that was approved. As for timeline, Scott can kind of maybe detail that a little bit better.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. So in terms of timelines, as Patrick identified, the Meditech solution is we're in active conversations with Health and Community Services, Department of Finance, and OCIO in terms of replacement of Meditech in what I'd refer to as the back office functions of that system, which are quite dated and fragmented. Patrick alluded to the fact that we do have a new inventory or warehouse inventory solution that was approved last fall. It's through a vendor, Texas. Which we will be implementing in 2 of our major distribution centers, one here in St. John's. As you probably noticed, the new warehouse on East White Hills is our St. John's distribution center, and one in Cornerbrook that opened last year. So we'll be modernizing those 2 distribution centers to be the main hubs of distribution of supplies, medical supplies, to all our facilities across the province. In terms of timelines, we foresee both distribution centers being fully operational by the spring. One likely before the other. The St. John's site actually includes the vaccine depot for the province, so there are some complicating factors in establishing that as it relates to the new software. But by June, we anticipate both distribution centers to be fully equipped with a modernized warehouse management system at that time. So June timeframe would be the latest. Earliest could be as early as April.
So what infrastructure are you using right now?
So at the moment, our warehouses are based on the Meditech platform that Patrick alluded to. It is quite dated. We actually have 4 instances of Meditech across NLHS from the legacy RHAs. That's still in place. As you can appreciate, those systems are not consolidated. They don't speak to each other, quote unquote, and there's a lot of fragmentation and lots of exposure related to that. But it is a Meditech platform that's currently used. Aside from that, there's general manual controls that are in place from an inventory perspective. So this really does modernize our warehouse consumable inventory and put controls in place that Patrick alluded to around proper inventory rotation, expiry, and wastage. That has been a major concern with an antiquated system that we're currently leveraging through Meditech. So it's going to put us quite ahead in terms of modernizing that space for the PHA.
Okay, so just to be clear, so the warehouse management system was approved in the fall, and you have 2 systems or 2 areas, and that's what you're moving to? Okay, all right. Auditing. So you did also speak about the internal auditing, but just can you just rehash, how are you auditing internally today?
So today, we don't have a formal internal audit function. Okay. We do have standard internal controls that are implemented in terms of best practice when it comes to internal audit in general terms. We also have our audited financial statements performed on an annual basis by the Office of the Auditor General in terms of our financial statement audit. There are also policies enacted that are in line with Treasury Board and provincial government in terms of things such as travel, hospitality, delegation of sign and authority. Those policies also provide a level of internal control. I think the biggest thing for us, as Patrick alluded to, is the implementation and the establishment of a formal internal audit office. An enterprise and an organization of government the size of NLHS certainly needs that function. And we foresee that function after being approved by government officials in terms of implementation. We're right now in the state of recruitment of a chief internal audit officer. This is an arm's length office from the organization. So it's a function that reports functionally to the Board of Trustees directly. And not to the organization per se or its leadership, and administratively to the CEO. So from day-to-day things such as payroll and other administrative functions, it does have a relationship to the CEO, but it does have a functional responsibility to the Board of Trustees. So it is objective in that sense of the word. So that's in the recruitment phases in terms of the chief audit officer, and from there that individual will form his or her office at that point.
Okay. So I'm guessing, like, the risk assessments. Oh, sorry.
I just had one thing. So similarly with the Office of the Comptroller General for the departments, they do offer internal audit, various internal audits for NLHS as well as the department. So just to add, that's who we use internally now as the Office of the Comptroller General.
So just based on the auditing, the internal auditing and the controls, the inventory controls and what have you, I was just trying to wrap my head around, like, the risk assessment component and the quality assurance component. How do you make decisions now to determine, what area within a hospital, within healthcare, would need funding? Needs, like, for example, is cardiac or oncology, like, we know everyone's pulling for money, every area is looking for investment. But how do you make those primary decisions of where the investment needs to go, say, in 2025?
It's a great question, and one that, you know, is a constant struggle in terms of understanding where priority areas are. But through the implementation of a risk register that we have as an organization, we understand where the primary risks are for the organization in terms of where funding is required. And that's both on the operating funding side, but also just as important as on a capital operating side or a capital funding side. We do have active governance structures internally in terms of understanding what priorities need to be met. And that comes from active conversations with our clinical partners, our frontline, in terms of where we see issues in terms of access that may need to be addressed through additional funding or the like. With the, and Dr. Parfrey can speak to this more eloquently likely, is the the guide that we have with the health in the health accord in terms of guiding our way forward, in terms of where we need to prioritize to make that a successful implementation. But that does provide us with a good blueprint, if you will, in terms of where our priorities are as a health system and where we should be prioritizing not only our operating funding allotment, but also turning the page to our capital side.
I will make a comment about that. I think that the Health Accord has gone through a massive public engagement with involving 128 different groups of people and 10 committees, and has been accepted by government as policy for healthcare delivery and for action on the social determinants of health, and has made fairly substantial investments in both those arenas. The reality is that the priorities that I have as the CEO and that the organization will have is written in the Health Accord. So people will know what they are. And on top of that, there is a blueprint for the Health Accord that discusses the implementation issues and how you could go forward with implementing each of those actions that were given priority. And it's the role, I suppose, of the NLHS executive to be able to determine what are the best ways to implement each of these actions, and that's ongoing. And I would like to say that of those 57 calls to action in the Health Accord, all of them have been acted upon either at a policy level or at an implementation level. But making policy is the easy part. The hard part is implementing it and dealing with the change management. And that's really what NL Health Services is engaged in at the present moment.
Thank you very much. That's all for me.
Okay, thank you, the member for LabWest.
Thank you, Chair. In the report there, the Auditor General made concern about the line of credit that has been taken up by the, I guess at the time was the individual health authorities, now it's consolidated into the NLHS. With the $660 million line of credit, what is the plan right now to deal with that amount of additional debt that was taken on by the authority?
Thank you for the question, MHE Brown. I think first and foremost, NLHS, in partnership with the Department of Health and Community Services and Department of Finance, acknowledges that level of borrowing is not fiscally sustainable. And there's been active conversations in the past 2 years in partnership around a vision or a way forward in terms of what we do to reduce that borrowing capacity in that light. I think there are a number of things that has led to that borrowing limit. And it's occurred over a number of years, and it'll likely take multiple years to get it back to something that is fiscally sustainable. But there are a number of, I guess, pointed strategies that's been enacted in the past couple of years as NLHS formed as a new provincial health authority, to which sort of addressing that. One, I think, in partnership with the Department of Health and Community Services, is addressing the structural deficit that was in legacy RHAs that had played a prominent role in where the line of credit has become. And that's been addressed in fiscal 24-25 with partnership from Patrick, the deputy, and others within the Department of Health. I think just as important, though, is what part NLHS plays in that sustainable vision going forward around borrowing. And one element that we've been seized with as an executive and a board over the past couple of years has been, as the RHA or the PHA forms and evolves, where are the efficiencies that can be harvested to help with that borrowing and being able to reduce the reliance on that borrowing capacity. So we have established a multi-year sustainability plan that we monitor quite regularly with the department and with our board of trustees to enable efficiencies to be harvested and used in a way in which we can leverage our and reduce our reliance on our borrowing capacity. The other piece of that is the reduction of agency resources. That's been a big play in recent years and a requirement for us to be successful in delivery of service in the health sector. But a plan to reduce that agency reliance is also enacted, and we're monitoring and reporting that quite regularly in terms of another big area in terms of efficiency finding and being cognizant of our responsibility around that. So I think in partnership, there are a number of levers that are being enacted to be able to reduce that line of credit over the coming years to be successful in that, in partnership with folks within the department and the Department of Finance.
Patrick Morrissey, thanks, Scott. I think as well, I just wanted to add, as part of the previous budget, you mentioned the 660 and the line of credit. So we obviously want to get that down to, frankly, a pre-pandemic, level. And in budget, there was $550 million approved over 2 years to pay down the line of credit to get us to a more, a line of credit that's just used for operational emergency purposes, right? Just to add to Scott's comments there. And I think in partnership with Health Transformation and NLHS, we work pretty closely on making sure there's accountability and value for money in every spend. That's a big part of us going forward and working towards that.
Thank you both for that. Sorry, Ben.
I'd like to make a comment. The idea that we have a line of credit and a borrowing facility would imply that we might have profligate spending. I don't actually think that's the case. I think that the structural deficit is really important, and the addition of having to pay for agency nurses, actions that are requested to take place that are unfunded, and wage increases on top of that are the things that are driving this, not profligate spending. And that necessity to have the borrowing capacity to keep the organization going is really important. But I think that the idea that you have one line of credit that you look after for the five zones is pretty important as well. But that requires a degree of planning that's challenging.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. What is the interest rate paid on the current line of credit right now?
Scott Bishop. So we currently have, as the evolution of the PHA as NLHS continues, we still have legacy bank authorities within previous existing bank institutions. So we actually have three institutions that we work with across the legacy RHAs as NLHS. So we do have a borrowing capacity amongst three institutions, all of which have a similar interest rate on our borrowing. Two of which is prime minus 0.5 basis points, and one of which is prime minus 0.8 basis points. So all in relative space. But nonetheless, as Dr. Parfrey alluded to, the ultimate game in terms of our standardization and evolution as a PHA is to standardize not only our systems, but our things like our banking institutions. And we're, that's part of a work plan over multiple years that will get us there. But at this point in time, we're dealing with three particular banking institutions with varying rates of interest, but relatively in similar terms.
Thank you so much. Also, with this right now, so I guess the ultimate goal is to consolidate everything into this. What is the time frame right now for consolidating the finances of the legacy RHAs and NLHC all into one? What is the current timeline for seeing that progression done?
So we have actually consolidated, while the systems remain unconsolidated and very fragmented, which is a problem in another sense of the word when it comes to reporting. But for all intents and purposes, for presentation to government and its official financial statements, presentation to government officials in terms of the Controller General, and for audit purposes with the Auditor General, our statements are consolidated at this point. And this will be the second year for our consolidated efforts in terms of consolidating our financial reporting. It's the systems behind that that's the segmented and fragmented part. But for consolidated reporting purposes, we are consolidated for all intents and purposes, for reporting purposes, whether it be for the Auditor General for audit, or for other reporting mechanisms up through the Department of Health for accountability reporting and general conversations.
Yeah, thank you. And for the consolidating of the systems, I guess is the more the bigger picture here too, I guess, as well, is what needs to be done. What is the time frame for your consolidation of systems? I know you mentioned a few things there with Meditech and that. What is the time frame you're working with now to try to get that all in house?
Another great question, and another really piece of work that's evolving over time. We spoke earlier about our warehouse systems, which is a major step forward for us. I guess the second piece of that would be the consolidation and the modernization, better yet, of our antiquated Meditech system, which is what we're using at the moment. There hasn't been a defined timeline for that system integration and consolidation. We are in active conversations with the department officials, OCIO, as Patrick talked about earlier, and the Department of Finance to leverage capacity around what a consolidation system could look like and what system that might be. But again, we're in the very early stages of that work plan, but I'm sure that will come to light sooner than later, and it will be a major benefit for us all.
Thank you so much. And I guess at the with the consolidation and everything like that, I guess we've had discussions, I guess, with the Comptroller General and stuff like that. But just, I guess, for the record and for public for knowledge of this, are you guys operating on an accrual-based accounting system?
Yes, we are.
All right. Thank you. That's my final question.
Okay. We'll move to the member for Lake Melville.
Thank you, Chair. Perry Trimper, MHA for Lake Melville. My colleagues have grabbed a lot of my thunder. Okay. Yeah, so, and it wasn't thunderous. But I'd just like to explore a little bit more on the same line of thinking as Jordan was just doing now around the collapse of the RHAs. I think you've got most of the elements, but I wonder if you could just summarize the disparity. You know, it's been interesting serving on this committee, watching, and as we've looked at different topics in the public accounts committee and different aspects, and it's been enlightening, I guess is one word, to see the differences in the four RHAs. I've become such a fan of this guy and Sister Elizabeth and the Health Accord, and I've just been welcoming, and it's back home in Labrador, everybody's, you need to be getting our Labrador system back, and I have so many arguments to push back on them. And I wonder if you could summarize maybe some of our questions, your thoughts, just on where we are now in terms of getting a good handle on spending, attacking that debt that we have that we need to work on, and a bit more on timelines. But I think you've got most of it. But I just wonder if you had a general comment on that.
Maybe I'll start. So the intent of the reorganization, I suppose you'd have, is that the Provincial Health Authority had responsibility for evolving plans on a province-wide level such that there was equity for every resident of this province with access to services. But the innovative part of it was that the regions needed to have input into how care was delivered in their regions. So the challenge was to ensure that the collaboration between the provincial approach and the regional rollout of services consistent with what the people wanted within their regions was going to happen. And that requires a kind of a matrix approach of organization and requires a collaboration between the various people there to make it effective. I would say that's a challenge, and I think it's evolving, and I think that the capacity of the provincial approach to influencing what happens in regions is going to get better. So that's a challenge for me, kind of coming into the job as a new person. I think the consolidation of the finances is really going to be dependent on that system that Scott was talking about. And to ensure that the services that are present in each of those regions are done to the best of our capacity, and that involves a certain number of ways of doing so. So there are a set of services that need to be available for the region itself around the areas that they believe to be the most important, family care and internal medicine and surgery and obstetrics and the allied pieces that go with it and their capacity to recruit to be able to provide those services, which is a challenge. That's kind of that basic set of suite of services that are necessary for a particular region and a particular district. And then there is the issue then of for regions that they're able to get access to tertiary level services. And that the idea there is that we need to be able to get tertiary level consultants to be able to travel to the people and to be able to treat the people in their own environment. That's actually happening. in Happy Valley Goose Bay Cardiology. I've visited there twice in the last few months. General surgeon has gone there several times to do endoscopy. So the idea of bringing the care to the people is getting traction. And then virtual care is improving. And it is totally capable. It is a priority, I think, but it's feasible to balance the virtual care with the in-person care that's necessary to be able to provide good care to a patient. An example I'd give would be, if you're living in Happy Valley Goose Bay and a woman had a breast lump, she might need to go, she currently might go to St. John's for imaging and then go back for the surgery and go back for the follow-up visit and go back for the next follow-up visit. Whereas the initial visit that's necessary could take place virtually, and the last two visits could take place virtually, and the provision of the imaging that's necessary could be provided in the region. So so what I'm saying there is that balanced approach to virtual care as against in-person care can evolve in such a way that the patient who's living far away can get good service, as good as you get in St. John's. So then so that's the idea of bringing the care to the people. And then the second idea is bringing the people to the care that's specialised. And examples of that would be somebody who's in Happy Valley Goose Bay with a myocardial infarction and needs a cardiac cath. Previously, there were delays in that transfer happening, but now with Heart Force 1, that transfer is happening much faster. And what the data demonstrates is that for every 100 patients that are transferred using Heart Force 1 for their cardiac cath, 25% stay in the hospital in St. John's, and the rest of them go home. They don't go back to their facility. So that's an example of bringing the people to the care. And clearly, we need to be as efficient as we possibly can. And I think the other element of that is around the air and ground ambulance system that the ground has been integrated, and the paramedics are now publicly paid workers, and the air is imminently been integrated, and the planning around getting helicopters to be able to be part of our system, and the planning around getting virtual or emergency care presented by professionals who are full-time on the job, so they look after the patient who's in the isolated area initially all the way through to coming to the place that they're meant to come to. That's evolving as well, and that integrated air ground ambulance system will occur this year. So that's a good example of bringing the patient to the care. So I think that the benefit of the Provincial Health Authority is thinking in a holistic sense about how every person in this province can get optimal care despite their isolation or despite the lack of services in their own particular area. And that's developing. Now, the piece that this organisation, what you guys are interested in, is to ensure that we live within our budget and that we consolidate our spending and that we get this electronic solution to allow us to be able to provide a provincial picture of what's happening in all the regions. That's what happen in the next, we hope, year if people respond fast. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I think it was an excellent answer. Thank you. I have two more thoughts. Where do you feel you are on your 10-year horizon? It was always the Health Accord. And are we on track? Do you feel that, I'm sure some aspects are moving well, others not so much, but do you feel that 10 years is still achievable?
I definitely do. Whether you get the health outcomes commensurate with the investment is another matter, because the health outcome, improvement in health outcomes are going to be dependent on action on the social determinants of health, not on how good the health system is. We have the highest spending in the country for healthcare. We have the worst health outcomes, and we have the worst health system performance. So our capacity to be able to change that health system in such a way that performance gets better and health outcomes get better is paramount. And clearly, we'll be trying to ensure that we evaluate every action that we take to see where we're getting to. In terms of all those actions that we recommend, and they are very substantial, and they involve an enormous amount of change, and they're very they're hard to implement. So people in the system feel under pressure, particularly at the senior level, because they're responsible for multiple portfolios. But the reality is that the government has made decisions consistent with the health accord to provide the money for major things like the health information system is a $700 million investment. Decision was made to do that. Family care teams requires money, and there's been already an agreement that $30 million has already been allocated in the budget to be ensure they happen. And the integration of the air ground ambulance system is another large financial outlay, which has been approved, in generally improved. So I think that the policy part of this is moving forward. The implementation part of it is where the challenges lie, to ensure that we get the performance of these multiple areas where change is difficult, and how we manage the change to be able to get the type of programs that we're looking for. And that's the area that I'm kind of most interested, that we're actually able to manage the change, that we're actually able to engage with the public and engage with the providers in such a way that they understand what we're trying to achieve, support it, and understand that when you put something into effect, it takes a long time for it to be implemented properly. So just the example of the personal care teams, you fund five of them and they get moving and you find out the problems that exist in trying to deliver team-based care in an arena that's not used to team-based care, and you introduce another five and you learn more things. So it's a process, and it definitely does not happen instantaneously. So that's so to answer your question, I'll finally answer your question. In terms of the implementation of the actions that are necessary, I think that within 5 years, all of them will be implemented, and all of them will be in some way, been able to influence the frustrations that exist for people around access and other, and quality, etc. And I think that within 10 years, we'll probably see improvement in particular health outcomes, but in terms of how we affect the life expectancy of the population, that's going to take longer than 10 years, because it's going to be driven by social factors that influence health.
Thank you. My time has expired. I'll come back with one later. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. We'll move to the member for Cape St. Francis.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Jody Wall, Cape St. Francis District. I have a couple of questions. As my colleague just said, several questions have been asked and answers have been given. Thank you for that. But I do want to go back to the debt. And my colleague from LabWest spoke specifically about the line of credit and the additional debt incurred. Mr. Bishop did say it's not fiscally sustainable. They have to address the structural deficit with a multi-year sustainability plan, if I got that correctly. And Dr. Parf, you just said that Newfoundland Labrador has the highest spending on healthcare in the country. So my question, first question is, why has NLHS experienced such substantial increases in debt? And I know you touched on it on a question from my colleague from LabWest a little earlier. I had difficulty in hearing part of your response. My fault, not yours. I'll see to that. However, experience a substantial increase in debt. Why NLHS are we at this point today, in your words?
In terms of trying to explain the debt. Go ahead.
Thank you for the question, MHA Wall. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's a multi-year, multifactorial issue that's been, the longevity of it spans multiple years across multiple legacy RHAs and entities that NLHS as a new entity certainly acknowledges is not sustainable, as I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the factors that are at play here, one of which I mentioned is probably the largest, has been the structural deficit that has been carried for multiple years across all the legacy RHAs. So in terms of structural deficit, there are a number of elements that roll out during any given fiscal period that adds or can add upward pressure on an approved spending model or an approved expenditure profile. And health is certainly no different than that, and we're actually probably more prone for upward pressure than any other industry. With lots of complicating factors, one of which, and certainly we're all familiar with, is the 2 years we had a COVID-19 pandemic, which had put a tremendous amount of pressure on the system, which added to an already structural deficit across a number of elements that had been existing in the RHAs. So that piece also played on that. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, there's also the element as a factor at play here is the recent upward pressure on the requirement for us leveraging agency resources from the private sector. And that has been something that we've been pressurized with in the past couple of years in particular, that we've been relying on those resources to deliver services across all of our zones. And no doubt has placed an upward pressure again on that borrowing capacity. So I think all in all, there are multiple factors of which that might be the biggest of those. So in terms of why we're here, I would suspect it's multifactorial. One being our structural deficit that has a continued upward pressure for lots of reasons. The other one would be our the play on COVID-19 and what that pressurized the health system as it relates to COVID-19 and the response for that. And thirdly would be the agency pressure point that we're currently experiencing and trying to wrangle a way forward in terms of what that means for us in terms of a more sustainable level of agency resources. And as Patrick alluded to, around pre-pandemic levels, there might always be a need for some sort of agency resources for remote areas, but something much more manageable and sustainable than we're in current state.
Just like to add to that, if you don't mind, clearly the amount of money we're spending is high, and clearly NL Health Services needs to be able to identify ways that they spend less money. And some of that might not be savings, some of it might be transferring in from money to services that are not working well enough because they're underfunded. But having said that, with the changes that have been made, it is likely that there would be actual savings in due course, particularly around the health information system, that will happen, particularly in back office functions that would come with using Oracle. Those savings would happen as well. And I think that there are issues around efficiency that we can do better with matching the number of providers that are necessary to deliver care that's actually being delivered. Again, using electronic capacity to do that would occur. And then, you got to remember as well that we're interested in trying to transfer as much of our care to the community as we possibly can and out of hospitals. So that piece is also going to be a financial challenge. Particularly if you take elderly, we're dependent on having a strong home support system that would allow people to stay at home for longer than they are. And we'd probably prefer to use personal care homes more frequently than long-term care facilities. And all that stuff requires action, I suppose. And if we got that, it might actually save us money because long-term care facilities are so expensive. So I think there will be a focus on where NLHS finds savings from the multiple things that they're actually doing.
Thank you both for that. And you just answered my next question with respect to what's your plan to reduce health sector cost. So that gives me a good idea on that. Thank you, Dr. Parfrey. Dr. Parfrey, in your opening statement, you said you were CEO since last Friday. We appreciate that. We do. But later on, you made a comment about your priorities for NL Health Services. So I'm just wondering, with respect to the outgoing Ms. Stone, CEO, have you discussed priorities with the outgoing CEO and what you have now, or do you have a new, with respect to financial priorities, what are your priorities financially for NLH Services going forward? Again, to answer all the questions right here with respect to debt and what have you, what are your priorities? Because you did allude to that, and I'd like to expand on it, if you would, sir.
Well, I think that Karen Stone, who is the interim CEO, would be very much aligned with the Health Accord and very much aligned with how we would go forward. Obviously, we're different people, so we do things in a different way, but the objective that we would have would be very similar. And I think that there's been a very substantial thought process given around finances. Where and how we can find savings and at what kind of a speed, and then how do we match that with the clinical priorities that we've got that that are related to the things that I mentioned, right? Better community care, decrease in surgical backlog, better access to a family doctor, better access to emergency rooms, more surgery, more imaging, and more access to that, all of which cost money, and all of which the public demand. So you've got this in this extraordinarily demand that will never go away, and which means that the health system will always be under stress and always be a political issue, because because the publicly funded system, the public are demanding, and they're going to keep demanding, right? So our challenge is managing our resources to be able to provide what we're able to provide.
Thank you for that. I do have one last question, and it came up from a comment that Mr. Bishop made with respect to the Chief Internal Audit Officer. Do you have a timeline on that recruitment for that important position? Because I'm sure that will indeed make a huge difference to NLH services overall.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And it's a good one, and one that the job has actually been posted since last fall. So it's been through a number of cycles of recruitment, and we have not yet, or I should say the board has not yet, been successful in their recruitment efforts. And that's been reposted, as I understand, for recruitment. But to your point, it is a major element of control for the organization, and one that not only executive but the board is looking forward to in terms of understanding what the role of that position will play in our financial sustainability. So it's a long-winded answer to say I don't, unfortunately, have a timeline. Sooner the better for us and the board. And I think that should roll out relatively quickly once we hire that Chief Internal Audit Officer, and he or she will then prepare themselves for a small audit office that will be functioning relatively quickly upon his or her recruitment.
Thank you for that. Is it an option to contract out the position, or are you looking for someone internal? Is a contract out option available for that?
The posting as it sits right now, it is an internal hire, not an internal hire, but a publicly funded hire under the auspice and umbrella of NLHS funding envelope. So it wouldn't be a contracted provider per se, it would be an internal position, reporting, as I mentioned earlier, functionally to the Board of Trustees, but administratively to the CEO. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your answers, it's much appreciated. That's it from me, Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Clean enforcing MHA exploits. Just a couple of times you mentioned care to community. How do you anticipate implementing this and anticipate a cost?
Community care is obviously widespread. It's got different elements to it. So I'll talk about the primary care delivery thought processes, which revolve around the fact that we have a deficit of family doctors, and we have part of our population doesn't have access to a family doctor. Now, the facts around that are that at our peak, the number of people looking for a family doctor through Patient Connect was 96,000, and it's now 48,000. And it's diminishing, and it'll diminish by another few thousand this month. And it's related to access to family care teams. And family care teams are driven by the idea that if we've got a deficit of doctors, we've got to think of other ways to be able to provide those services, preferably by providers within whom the scope of practice exists for them to be able to provide some of that. So these family care teams have not only have doctors, but they have nurse practitioners and nurses and allied health professionals, and they're then considered to be able to contact with those resources that are in the community, like community care, care of the elderly, etc. So that's the vision for them, and they have started, and they're provided about $2 million of new funding to be able to make them work. And I think in the budget is approximately $30 million that's already been allocated towards family care teams. The second piece is of community care now, as it reflects on family practice, is around virtual care. And virtual care has allowed us to keep emergency rooms open where you don't have a doctor, but it's open, they can come into a nurse and they can use virtual care to access a doctor. So that's that solution to not having a doctor. And then the third one is the one I mentioned, which is the big one, which is if you get a heart attack or a stroke in an isolated area, can you have access to the best care? And that's driven by having an integrated air ground ambulance system and a better emergency service from the doctors attached to that air ground ambulance system. The costs of all, there's costs exist to all of those, clearly you'd like to think that that massive amount of money that NLHS gets, that they're able to provide these services within that envelope. But nonetheless, at the beginning, it's a challenge because it's a new amount of money that you're, in some instances, a new amount of money. In other instances, not, right? The family care teams have been funded in the budget. The air ground ambulance system, it's the likelihood is it will be funded in the budget. So that part of it is probably reasonable, but it's increasing spending. Then you've got the other part I mentioned, which is around the big challenge for us around care of the elderly and home support and letting people age at home. And that is driven by the home support industry, which is fragmented and the workers are not paid very well. And it's hard to recruit as a consequence of that stuff. But we need to be able to improve community care for the elderly in such a way that they're actually able to stay at home. I think they're the two big things, but they're two big changes.
Okay, thank you. NLHS total tangible capital assets is around $2 billion. Currently, there is no fixed asset to support that balance. You mentioned a new system is being planned, which should address this deficiency. When do you anticipate this being in place?
Scott Bishop, great question, MHA4C. I think, as I mentioned earlier, there is no confirmed timeline for the replacement of the antiquated Meditech system. But I guess in response to where we are now, while we don't have an official systematic fixed asset register, we do have mechanisms in which we control our fixed assets. While that's quite manual at this time, there are controls in place for that in terms of how assets are properly categorized in terms of amortization for audit purposes and other. In terms of timelines, in terms of where we will be for, Dr. Parfrey alluded to the Enterprise Resource Planning Tool, which is our ultimate modernized solution that we will be aiming for. I suspect it will be in the next 12 plus months before we get there. But it will be a game changer for not only our fixed asset tracking, but also for our general day-to-day things such as payroll and other accounting functions that right now are quite fragmented.
Thank you. Government as a formal fraud management system, the report noted that money going into this do not have such systems in place. Can NLHS discuss your fraud management system?
Thanks for the question. So I think in terms of fraud management, the report from the Auditor General speaks about fraud management policy and strategy. NLHS does have a fraud management policy in line with government policy. We do run a fraud management campaign annually from an awareness perspective across the organization, in ensuring that people have a legitimate mechanism in which they, for most importantly, report fraud, and then what happens when fraud is reported. And that would include escalation to the executive, to our board, to the department, and ultimately to the Auditor General upon audit of the organization. So there is a fraud management and related policy in place of NLHS, and that's in line with the government's fraud management policy. Yeah.
Thank you. As do other government entities, NLHS uses credit facilities, a form of debt-like line of credit, as part of its cash management strategy. What efforts are being undertaken to reducing NLHS's reliance on credit facility to fund its operating expenses?
Once again, thanks for the question. I think this one maybe alludes to a previous response provided, but I think I think the line of credit has gotten here over multiple years, and it'll likely take multiple years to have that reduced to a balance in which is more financially sustainable. And there's a number of factors that has led to that balance, and likely multiple factors that will lead to its reduction. One of which I talked about earlier was a multi-year sustainability plan that we've established over the next 3 years, which has a fairly sizable quantum of savings. And as Dr. Parfrey alluded to, as the system continues to evolve and efficiencies are gained through system wins, we are currently implementing an HIS, Health Information System, EPIC, which will lead to significant efficiencies. And likewise, when we get to the back office or business operations of the organization with a modernized ERP system, it will also further enhance the ability to find efficiencies in that regard. The other big lever in this would be the conversation around the reduction of agency or the reliance of agency resources. That is a big play right now in terms of our spend, and we're looking to curtail that over time. And of course, in partnership with the department in terms of understanding the creep that we often see in structural deficit and making sure that that's addressed so that we don't have to turn to borrowing capacity to be able to facilitate that in terms of funding.
Okay, thank you. I'll continue now with the member for Mount Pearl North.
Thank you again. You talked about pressure points and savings in health. I'm just wondering if the community value have played a big part, people taking community value. I don't know if you can answer that, but is there more people taking advantage of the community value, and is that a hardship or a burden on the system?
That might be one that I can't answer, and one that's likely more prominently asked to the pension administrator, which would be Provident, might be more prone to talk about the impact on that.
That's it for me for questions.
Okay, thank you. We'll move to the member for Placentia St. Mary's.
No further questions from me. Thank you very much for being here this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. Member for Live West.
Thank you. Just a little bit off topic. I'm asking for Perry. Off the scope of the hearing, however, Perry's going to ask him. He got 2 minutes.
Thank you. I apologize. I have to run to another event, but I had two points I wanted to make. One is that this morning we had a great discussion on the strategic investing that is occurring province-wide, handling sinking funds, and just that fractions of a percentage and what it's resulting for the provincial treasury. I'm assuming your team is doing the same thing with that 600 plus million, but I just wanted to put that thought out there.
That might be better question for the Department of Finance.
I suspect they're all over it, but it was an interesting topic, and then they came with some additional information this morning. For example, I think last year they said they were able to in handling their debt in a very proactive, aggressive, strategic way, they were able to result in a windfall of some $70 million just to handle the $1.5 billion, whatever it is, on borrowing costs. So it was just an interesting revelation. And then, my final point, I apologize, I got to run again. I sit in on the all-party mental health and addictions committee, and we had a tremendous, I was very excited about the reviews from the pilot studies on the family care teams and what's going on there. And I just encourage you, as soon as you can, to get some messages out about it, because it really is exciting news, and it's cutting down access to doctors. And the sooner we can get that out, the better. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. I didn't realize we had a new member for Lab West, so we'll see if the original member from Lab West got a question.
No, I was doing that on behalf of MHA Trimper as he was on the way at the door. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you, member for Cape St. Mary's. Cape St. Francis.
Thank you, Chair. Nothing else from me. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for your responses today. They are appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's just about ends the questioning line of questioning. So again, we do thank you for being here, and I'll ask the Deputy Minister, the Interim CEO, if there are any closing remarks.
I'll just say that the whole issue of spending and how we spend and how we match our priorities with the money that's available to us is important. And I think that we want to be able to address the needs of the population within the funding envelope of the province. That is central to what we're trying to achieve. And the Health Accord made that statement. It said that the primary things for us are to increase awareness and intervention in the social factors that influence health, and to rebalance the health system across the acute care, long-term care, and the community within the fiscal envelope of the province.
Thank you. I'll ask the Deputy Auditor General if she has any closing remarks.
I just want to thank the officials from the Department of Health and Community Services and LHS for their time here today. I thought it was a very good discussion on some of the topics that came out of our February 2024 report. And yeah, I just thought it was really good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Deputy Auditor General. It's always good to know that we're doing our job on behalf of the public accounts and the Auditor General's office to maintain that government efficiencies are being maintained, and that's our role. Again, we do thank the departments and the department officials being here, and we'll recess for the next entity. Thank you. Okay, thank you. I think we're ready to start. So in this portion of the public hearing, the committee will be hearing from the Department of Children, Seniors, and Social Development. I would like to thank the witness for the appearance and welcome the officials of the following officials. Alan Duty, Deputy Minister. I will start with a few reminders for the witness. An outline of how the hearing will proceed before I call the clerk to swear and affirm the witness. Witnesses are reminded that this is a public meeting and the testimonies here today will be on public record. Witnesses appearing before the Standing Committee of the House of Assembly are entitled to the same rights granted to members respecting parliamentary privilege. Witnesses may speak freely. And what you say in this parliamentary proceeding may not be used against you in a civil proceeding. Live audio will be streamlined on the House of Assembly social media channels, and archived versions will be available following the hearing. Answered will also be available once finalized. When called upon to speak, activate your microphone, identify yourself, saying your first name, and please remember to turn off your mic once you're finished speaking. First, I'll ask the Deputy Minister to make opening remarks. Then the committee members will pose questions in turn of 10-minute periods, and these rounds will continue until the members have exhausted their questions. I'll now ask the clerk to administer the oaths to the witness.
I, Alan Duty, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm and declare that the evidence that I shall give on this examination shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Thank you. I'll call upon the Deputy Minister now to bring opening remarks.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here to answer your questions this afternoon. I'm not going to be lengthy with opening remarks. I'm just going to give some general overview of the income support program so everybody has a shared understanding. So the income support program is designed to support clients from the age of 18 to 64. There's approximately 21,000 households, which equates to 22,150 adults receiving income support. The annual budget for income support is $225.6 million. The program is designed as a program of last resort. So when people come to receive income support benefits, they are at the point where they've exhausted all of their other financial means. The department has several integrity measures for the program through application process and to when people are involved with the program. But relevant to the proceeding today, the integrity measures are largely related to data matching with federal programs and other provincial programs where people may have received funds and income. We often receive reports from the public in relation to people receiving income support, which and all of those are investigated. Specifically relevant to today's hearing on overpayments. So the reasons for overpayments vary across. So depending on personal circumstance, and sometimes people and individual circumstance will change while people are on the program. For the most part, the largest items which contribute to income support overpayments are advance payments before people receive other benefits such as CPP, EI, and things of that nature. There is also and that also includes things like supplementary death benefits and things as well. The other large contributor to that is also the, So the other piece that contributes to that significantly, I have it here in my notes, I apologize, is family relationships. So how people report family relationships and income earnings. So those are the three major contributors prior to CERB. And since the COVID pandemic and CERB, that's CERB accounts for almost 62% of what we're recording as overpayments. It's also important to acknowledge that funds that are advanced in to help people, so while they're waiting to bridge the gap between other benefits like CPP and EI and OAS overlap, are automatically collected back. So they show up on the books, but they're actually automatically collected back through the federal government. And sometimes it takes time for that to reconcile by the time that payment's received. So at any moment in time, those will be on the books shown as an overpayment, but they're always recovered. For individual circumstances, for most folks, some of these items are related to, people work part-time. Sometimes they may not always report their earnings. And again, back to declaring family relationships, which actually ends up being historically the largest reason why we have those recorded. What I can tell you that over the last 2 years in particular, there's been a review, the five-year review of the income support program, and coming out of that are changes to income support policy, significant changes to the program itself, and it's part of the poverty reduction plan, which has been announced. So the program is moving over the last 2 or 3 years. The final changes will be in this fiscal year coming, but it's moving from a 23 basic benefits down to 4 basic benefits, and there's 5 some additional benefits that people may be able to apply for, such as special dietary things of that nature. But really, the changes are really focused on not being so interested on where people live or who they live with, but actually supporting them. So right now, this change will significantly reduce the family relationship piece, where really we're trying to encourage folks to actually not forcing those that are living in poverty to have the lie so that they can, come up with the relative means that they need to live. So there's changes, going to be changes to those. The basic benefits for individuals will be, the big change will be that their basic benefit will relatively stay the same for all folks, and then their rental amounts will be topped up to reflect that there's one or two adults living in those households. So that's kind of my overarching introductory remarks, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we'll continue with the questioning, and I'll now recognize the member for Mount Pearl North to proceed with questions.
Thank you, and thank you so much for your staff and all the work that they do in the Department with Income Support. And my name is Lucy Stoyles, but I'm MHA from Mount Pearl North. And one of the questions I had, you basically answered it, was the high overpayments and the large increase in the overpayments. And you basically answered my question, because you said 62% is because of COVID, because people took the COVID money and they were on income support, and now they're forced to pay it back. And of course, we get the calls on a regular basis back, especially when they started getting the repay back. So that was one of the questions I had. But, you know, I'm just wondering, you only allow them to take 5% of, is it 5% of the money for payback? Like, I know seniors who were getting their old age pension and the guaranteed income subsidy. And I know you work very closely with CRA and Revenue Canada and that to claw back the money that when people get an overpayment and stuff like that. So I basically got that question. And anyway, go ahead and answer that one first.
Yes, Alan, and thank you for the question. So if they're an existing income support client and we're collecting overpayments, we do collect 5%, which equates for most clients about be about $28 a month. So that's the amount which we, because this is recognizing that income support is really the safety net. So it is the program of last resort. So we do only claw back at a 5% rate for those individuals. And then individuals that are no longer active on the income support program, so that those files are passed to DGSNL, and because they do the collections for folks that are not active on the income support program. So I couldn't speak to their policies specifically, but those would be handed off to those individuals to their collection team at DGSNL.
Yeah, I think they go beyond. I think I turned it on and turned it back off again. When someone puts a complaint in against somebody on income support, if it's a family member, is that taken as serious as somebody? Because we look at all the different overpayments and you know, I know you have a review when a complaint comes in, is they can appeal it and go through the process. And after all that's done, the question I have is, is there another process for them? If they said, no, I don't owe that money, I was wrongly accused, and is there any other avenue? I mean, they got no money, obviously, to go to court to fight to say, I don't do it, but especially if it's a family member that complained about somebody. Yeah, I'm just wondering what the process is.
Yeah, so regardless of the source of the complaint, like there's a due diligence from to validate whether or not it's true, and that starts with questioning of the client and then whatever documents they may provide. I don't necessarily have statistics on how many of those are founded and unfounded, but so from that perspective, they are, you know, so the same process is followed regardless of the source of the complaint. If there is any dispute regards to their income support, there is an appeals board that will listen to those and render a decision. So it does remove it then from the staff that are involved in that process. That's an independent body that would review that information to make a decision on the income support.
Thank you very much. That's it for me for now.
Okay, thank you. We'll continue with the member for Placentia St. Mary's.
Hi, Sherry Gamma-Walsh, Placentia St. Mary's. So I have a little bit of a different question. So you're alluding to the changes in the income support program and that there's going to be a little bit of a different focus on it. I really like to hear the fact that you indicated that there will be a basic benefit that will stay the same, and then the rent will be based on the number of people who reside in the dwelling. That's a really good change. But I'm just wondering right now for, and I know there's been some changes to this also, but I'm just wondering about the policies and how you're doing this right now. So individuals who are actually receiving income support, initially there was like a yearly financial review of that particular individual done by the social workers. So what is the policy around that financial review and who actually is doing it now?
Yeah, so I mean, this is one of the items that we're also in the process of changing from an operational perspective. So the system is not designed currently the way the program has been designed to support a more hands-on case management. So that those changes are coming now in this fiscal year. We're going to move to a case management model to assist clients. That's twofold. It's part of an integrity measure, but it's also ensuring that we're providing clients with the right supports to help connect them with the labor force and things of that nature to help them, you know, be able to live their best possible life. So those things are coming. The review, every file is reviewed every 2 years minimum. So that so it's not annual, it's every 2 years based in the current system. But that's one of the things, items that we're going to be changing with the case management. The reduction of the administrative burden in the changes that are coming to the income support program are going to provide the capacity for that change. So within the staff, because, so that's where that's headed. So, and those are conducted, those reviews can be either client service officers or social workers, depending on the needs we'll be doing. But most of the financial reviews are done within the like the income support staff themselves, like the client service and individuals of that group. There is a specific investigative unit that deals with investigations of income support clients.
Okay, so just want clarity. So every 2 years, the individuals, there's a financial assessment done on the individual, and who actually gathers the information from the families or the individuals?
Yeah, so income support, like case management staff, will be reaching out to clients to do the follow-up with them and collect that information.
Okay.
It's broader than that as well, because we are doing, of course, all of the data sharing across the federal government and other provincial programs. So like this may initiate that. So that's done regularly. That's done more frequently. But so some of those clients may be flagged and maybe, you know, engaged with earlier than the 2 years based on that work. But every file is looked at every 2 years.
So there is data sharing with the federal government?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Let's see, because you're after answering a good many questions. So preventative measures within the department that are put in place to limit the number of overpayments made, what types of active preventative measures are in place today?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of activities that have been implemented over the last 2 years to address some of those items, and others existed, like already existed, especially the data sharing pieces and things of that nature. And of course the volume of client data being provided through, because of the CERB initiative, has been really onerous on staff to get through that. So we still haven't completed all that data validation related to CERB, but we're on track to have that done by March this year, March 2025. So there some other initiatives is to ensure, so previously the program had one time had eliminated the requirement for clients to file tax returns. And so we have since changed that requirement and implemented the requirement for clients to file tax returns. I want to be clear too, that that's really supporting clients as well. Like, so, cause you know, depending on the capacity of the client and their needs, like they need support for that. That's also twofold reason why we are making that change. The first is not integrity of the program is very important, and that's helps with the data sharing with the federal government, and then it helps target those individuals that are getting income from other sources, which prior to the CERB was probably about a third of the overpayment collection. But also from a social policy perspective is that folks who don't file income tax miss out on benefits. So they miss out on benefits from the federal government and also from the provincial government that are tied to tax filing, which will also help enhance their life. So we are really pushing on that as well, so that they're maximizing all the programs that are available to them. And over the last couple of years, there's been, you know, money from both provincially and federally that have been issued based on income. And folks are missing out on that if they haven't filed, that are outside of regular programs, if they haven't filed their taxes.
Can you share any of the other changes that are coming? You said we're going down to 5, or what did you allude to there? Could you just elaborate on that?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely. So there's currently, the system has 23 basic benefits that, and it's actually pretty complex. Like, some of it's based on age category and parents and things of that nature, but we're reducing it down to 4 basic benefits, and there'll be 5 additional benefits, which will include like the single parent supplement, Coastal Labrador allowance, there's a blind person supplement, a special diet supplement, and a dietary food allowance. But individual benefits will be standardized for everybody, and then a single accommodation benefit, and there'll be a shared accommodation benefit, and then a household expense benefit. So those will be the benefits that'll be reduced to. And I'm happy to share a document with the committee so they can actually see that the high level changes instead of going through them all verbally.
That'd be perfect because I'm here scribbling it all down right fast. Thank you very much. That's all the questions for me.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll move to the member for Lab West.
Thank you, Chair. Just going back to, the overpayments and that, and you mentioned that CERB was about 60% of the current files for overpayments. How much was spent on resources to deal with these overpayments and collection, and did it outweigh what the individuals did receive in CERB? Was there a cost analysis done on the benefit of actually trying to recapture this money, or was it is the department utilizing a lot of resources which probably would outweigh the benefit of trying to recapture this money? So was there any cost analysis done in that sense?
Yeah, well, sorry, I mean, it's an excellent question.
Mike?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no worries.
No, thank you, and that's an excellent question. I think if we just go back even pre-CERB, so the department recuperates roughly about $3.5 million a year on overpayments, and overpayments pre-CERB were, you know, in the realm of $6 to $8 million. So it does, it from a cost-benefit perspective, it actually does. We didn't grow staff to deal with the CERB issue, and this is why we're now in 2025 and we're still doing the same staff, we're doing that data matching. And so we haven't grown resources. It's just late being added to. So you'll see over the last 3 years now, this year as well, you'll see a larger increase in overpayment. So the cost benefit analysis, we are recouping more than a cost, significantly more, I would suggest, the cost than to actually have staff go through that process.
And out of all this, out of all your overpayments and that, how much has been declared unretrievable? Has the an individual passed, or just you're just not going to get it back? There's no way to get it back. How much of it has been declared that so far?
Yeah. So from the way it works currently is that if you're a client of CSSD, we are collecting. So we CSSD per se isn't writing off.
Okay.
We're collecting from clients at a very small amount, but we're collecting from clients. And the other portion of that, it moves to DGS&L collections for collection. And they would have to actually respond to that. I don't actually have that number in front of me. I can get it for you, but I don't have it here with me.
No, that's fine. I guess this leads into my next question. I guess between DGS and yourselves, we know that, and it's been pointed in, through the Auditor General's office, and that there's some clients that bounce back and forth between collections with you and collections with DGS, and then they become a client again and go back and forth. And this probably muddies the waters of what's owed and what's not. But what is the was it the communication between the two when it comes to collections and that? Is it a very frequent, or is it just more or less a file transfer? Because it could, from what the Auditor General pointed out, it could be an issue, potential issue, with the clients going back and forth between the two.
Yes, so we have a memorandum of understanding with DGS&L on that. At the operational level, the director responsible for income support and the director responsible for collections are in. I would say they're in. I won't say constant, but they speak frequently on specific cases, and so there is information sharing and data sharing in relation to that to ensure that there's no gaps.
All right, and I guess with the you said 60% currently on of the workload is CERB related when it comes to overpayments. Can you give a better breakdown of the remaining workload on where these overpayments come from?
Absolutely, and my pleasure to do so. So I'll use 23-24 data. So overlap payments like CPP, EI, and OIS, which we 100% recoup back. It's just there's always a portion on the book based on time delay. So that in 23-24, that accounted for 5% of the overpayment data. So the, but prior to COVID, that was 15%. Security deposits, which is really us helping folks make their damage deposits to landlords. That's what that equates to. In 23-24, that's 3% of the, and the reason why those numbers are lower, it's because you have that balloon number related to CERB, so it just lowers the percentage. Yeah. But it's important to note over a year, like they're probably plus or minus a couple hundred thousand dollars between each of them, so they've almost stayed pretty close to the same. So that was 8% in prior to COVID. CPP death benefits is 1% in 23-24, and prior to COVID, that was about 3%. Change in living arrangements, so when people move in together or they move out and they do not advise, so that's 3% prior to COVID, and 6% before COVID, and 3% in 23-24. Folks who are involved with the justice system and incarcerated prior to, in 23-24, 1%. And prior to COVID, they equated to about 3% of the overpayments. Income earnings in 23-24 is 12%, and prior to COVID was 36%. And what we call false pretenses as a title within CSSD, which is really about individuals' family situations and things of that nature that people haven't declared. It's 11% in 23-24, and it was 22% pre-COVID.
Thank you so much. And the total value currently that's sitting on the books of overpayments that are being recouped, what's the total value right now that is trying to be recouped?
So in this report, I believe it was $95 million. So that's accumulated from the beginning of the program. So that's not, but in 23-24, I think overpayments were at approximately $21
million. So it was $21 million at this point, but what, as of today's numbers, do you have today's numbers of what you're trying to recoup?
I don't have that number in front of me. I do know that it's increased in the total. So it'll be approximate. I believe it's around $113 million.
Perfect. All right, that's the end of my questioning. Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We'll move now to the member for Cape St. Francis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for being here today. Thanks to my learned colleagues, I'm down to two questions. But all good questions and all good answers. With respect to overpayments, what's the number of investigations annually that the department would have to complete with respect to overpayments?
I don't have the exact number of how many investigations are done by staff. The which I can get that though and provide it to the committee. The so the straight data transfer pieces are not investigated. Like this is a reconciliation of our data versus the other data, those processes are automated. But the other investigation types, I can get you that number. I don't have it here with me.
Okay, thank you. And I know my colleague from LabWest asked the amount that was recouped. Am I correct in my notes, $3.5 million? Is that correct?
That's what CSSD collects.
Okay.
Just on folks who are within our system.
Within your purview. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
On average. That's an average per year.
Okay, thank you for that. And one more, it's been said with respect to DGSNL, with their collection team, when an individual comes off income support, it goes to that department. And I know my colleague from LabWest mentioned about the communication between departments, and you said about the director. Annually, what's the number of files that come from your department to DGSNL that have to be followed up by their staff with respect to collections?
Yeah, I apologize. Sorry, no, that's fine. I do apologize because I actually don't have that number with me, but I can get that number. I think the caseload we've seen significant reduction in caseload, over the last decade. So, but I'll get you the exact number because I don't want to state a number that's false. Yeah.
No, understood. I appreciate that. And this again comes from conversations we're having and whatnot. But anyway, that's all my questions, Chair. Thank you, and thank you for your answers.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Pleeman Forsey, MHA for exploits. I do have a couple of questions. I know now going down the line that most of the questions are being taken up, but I do have a couple of questions anyway. What portions of the overpayments are occurring due to fraudulent activity?
Yeah, so an excellent question. So the terminology used in the department for a long period of time has been false pretenses. It's complex to answer because once staff investigate, they are trying to determine the willingness of people who are trying to willingly defraud government, or if this is just a circumstance which they, some cases where folks may not have realized the rules, we're not following up with them frequently enough, that type of thing. So it is complex. There are cases which we do deem to be fraudulent, where we know that people were not necessarily required to be in receipt of income support and may have provided false documentation and things of that nature, which are investigated or referred to the police for investigation. I don't have that exact number for you for today, but I can certainly also get that.
Thank you. How often do you review accounts to identify amounts with no expected time of collections?
Yes, that's an ongoing.
No expectation of collection, sorry.
Yes, thank you for the question. That's an ongoing process within the Corporate Services Division for those that are active files. So, for example, we may have an individual who's a 62-year-old who may owe us a certain amount of money, and we know that they're on income support, and the likelihood of us collecting that from them is doubtful. So, we may reduce the amount that we expect to from a reporting perspective. So, it is ongoing. I would suggest it's not like done once a year. It's regular occurrence for those files to be reviewed, and once they're off the income support. Again, this goes to DGSNL, and I'm not certain what their process is on how they determine when they can collect or not collect money. I'd have to refer to them.
So are any of those amounts being written off?
Traditionally, within CSSD, we do not write them off because we're still collecting from clients, even though we inventory it as a portion of that being doubtful. Almost all write-offs that are done, which I still sign off as deputy, recommend for come from DGSNL, recommended by the collections group, or recommended to CSSD for write-off through their collections process.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions on that right now. I think but I will go down the line. If I do see a light on either one of the members, I'll move to them. Anybody got a question?
I just want to say thank you, but in the observation of 62%, if the 65%, 62% is COVID related, so basically is a good program when you look at 3%, whether it's fraudulent or whatever reason, it could be an EI or it could be any reason. So really at the end of the day, prior to COVID, and the serve money, I mean, you're doing a good job. So I just want to again say thank you for coming today and for the information.
Thank you for that, and I'm sure staff would appreciate that sentiment, so thank you.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions. I'll say that we've exhausted our questioning, and I do thank the Deputy Minister for being with us today and asking those questions. And I'll ask the Deputy Minister if there are any closing remarks in this matter.
So first of all, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here and to answer your questions. I just wanted to reiterate, if there's ever any question related to the program, please do not hesitate to reach out to our office, and I'll follow up with the questions that I didn't have the data for you here today. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, and I'll ask the Deputy Auditor General if there's any closing remarks on her part.
I'd just like to thank the Deputy Minister for his time and the opportunity for the Public Accounts Committee to discuss some of the items that were raised in our report from February 2024 that involved CSSD. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Again, thank you to the Deputy Minister from Department of Children, Seniors and Social Development for his attendance and testimony today. We are now at the end of the, today's proceedings. Before we clue up, I will. I would like to extend on behalf of the committee thanks to the officials from the Office of the Auditor General for their support and attendance today as well. Thank you. I also extend my thanks as chair to all the members of the Public Accounts Committee for your dedication and commitment to this important work. Also, again, thank you to our broadcast technician, Dan Warren, for being here today. And with no further business, I'll now call for a motion to adjourn the public accounts hearing. Okay, a member of Mount Pearl North. All those in favor? Aye. Aye. All those against? This public hearing now stands adjourned. Aye.